is the Podmatic Podcast for September 16th, 2015. Estamos aquí.
Okay.
Podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Bill,
Sarah.
Sarah is back.
Yay. You're so excited, Bill.
Well, I am. First time I've ever podcasted with Sarah.
Really?
This is,
she's usually here for you. Interesting combination.
And with the comic book boys out, all of us probably get more of a word in edgewise.
Yeah, you're going to hear from more of us.
As you can hear from the echo, we're recording in the visitor's bullpen of First Tennessee Park. We jumped the fence to get in here, but the Nashville sound season is officially over.
Aww.
So I think we're good for now. We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville while the children's department of the main library is being remodeled. So today is the second day of Hispanic Heritage Month. The library is going to have programs at all our branches. And did you know that Hispanic Heritage Month starts in the middle of September? Because around that time, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Mexico, Chile, and Belize celebrate their independence. The library goes crazy every Hispanic Heritage Month, but this year is really special. We have a year-long program called Estamos Aquí. What does that mean?
I was going to ask you that.
We are here.
Oh. Yeah, that's right.
Estamos Aquí is a programming initiative exploring the culture and history of Latino Americans in Nashville and the United States. We have a ton of local partners. We're going to host film discussions, art exhibits, recording oral histories. A bunch of gringos will awkwardly flounder through a podcast. But two really big programs with, I think, a lot of appeal will be we'll be screening Latino Americans, a six-part PBS film series, and only libraries that are participating in Estamos Aquí, or got a grant anyway, will be able to show this publicly.
And so this is like a nationwide program. It's not just our library program.
You know what? I have to plead host ignorance. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Estamos Aquí is what every library that's participating is calling it, but that's what we're calling it, right?
Okay.
Special thanks to Amber Williams, librarian in the Special Collections Department, for coming to the rescue on this issue. Latino Americans 500 Years of History is a program made available by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the American Library Association. We are one of 203 libraries that got this grant. This enables us to show the six-part series, Latino Americans. But around this core program, we will be doing programs all year here at NPL with our community partners, and we're calling this initiative Estamos Aquí, 500 Years of Latino American History. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast. Revel Fusion will be here for Concert in the Courtyards on October 6th. And those draw a ton of people anyway, but they're also here as part of Estamos Aquí. So today, we're going to tell you about the best Hispanic books, movies, and music. Seriously, though, I think we are a bunch of gringos.
Guilty.
And much like in past years, our goal will be not to offend anyone.
That is a good goal.
Sometimes we're successful, sometimes.
Amanda, is the spirit moving you?
Sure. I actually have to be honest and admit that I wasn't really thrilled when we were discussing Hispanic Heritage Month. Not that I have anything against Hispanic culture. I don't. I love their culture. I love the cuisine. It's muy bueno. I just really don't, as a habit, read a lot of Hispanic authors. And over the many, many, many...
Six.
Many years of the Pop Medi podcast, I've kind of already talked about the handful of Hispanic authors that I do read. So when you had brought that up, I was kind of like, I don't know who to talk about. In podcast audience, I'm not going to lie, Brian totally called me out on this. I can't really repeat what he said. partially because I have blocked it from my memory, and partially because it got kind of colorful.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, it got kind of colorful. Kind of were brainstorming, and we were throwing things around, and someone jokingly said that we can do an all John Leguizamo podcast. Well, guess what? A, I love John Leguizamo. B, he wrote a biography. C, we have it. And D, I read the whole thing. Challenge accepted. So I think part of the reason I never really thought about John Leguizamo is because I think I thought he was Italian and not Spanish. But actually, he was born in Colombia, South America. And he and his family didn't move here until he was actually 4 years old. I think the first time I remember seeing him in anything was when he played Tybalt in Baz Luhrmann's modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet.
Tybalt is the essence of the play. He's the one that makes the whole thing spin around him because it's his rage and his hurt and his anger that really propelled the rest of the movie into the final third act because his misunderstanding of things and his selfishness.
Which I really like, despite what everybody says. If you don't like it, I don't want to hear about it. and then I saw him when he was in Summer of Sam, which I actually had watched for Adrian Brody, but I ended up liking John better. And I know that John also did one of the voices in Ice Age. But as I've already mentioned, John wrote a biography in 2006 called Pimps, Hoes, Playa Haters, and All the Rest of My Hollywood Friends. And I was actually writing that down so I would have it in my notes. I realized for the first time that it was called Playa Haters and not Playa Hats. But I think Playa Hats would have been just as cool because he always wears cool hats. So we're going to rewrite that for Popmatic podcast style. The book is real. It's gritty. It sounds just like John, which is probably because he didn't have 15 ghostwriters to finger quotes help him write it. The two biggest things I took away from the story are, one, John is smart, like S-M-R-T smart, like Jeopardy smart. And he's also a hustler. He works really hard. And sometimes people think that being an actor is just about being pretty. But they were talking about, like, all the times he was writing his one-man shows and he was workshopping them and doing them, like, it's all him. Like, he doesn't have a crew of 15 people helping him. He's just doing it himself. And I think also because he's a writer that even when he hasn't written the exact material he's performing, he's always trying to improve it, do improv on it to make it better to better fit his character, which sometimes his directors like and sometimes his directors really don't like. But it doesn't stop him from trying. A lot of the material in the book ended up in his fourth one-man stage show called Ghetto Clown. That's K-L-O-W-N. The library actually has a DVD called Tales from a Ghetto Clown that shows the behind-the-scenes footage of how the show was produced. And I actually watched it first, so it was interesting to kind of go back and see the skits performed on stage and then read the book and get, oh, that's where that came from. Oh, now he's talking about Grandpa. Okay, we got it. And I have always enjoyed watching John Leguizamo, and now with all this other material, I have a great respect for him as an artist. And I can't wait for September 2016 when we honor Hispanic Heritage Month again, so I can bring you John Leguizamo 2.0. And I'm out. I can't do a mic drop because that would damage the equipment, but... Yeah.
So John Leguizamo, that's the same that did Luigi, right?
Yes, and he talks about that. He's kind of like that was, like, and he gave up some great role to do that movie, and he's like, that was, yeah. He, like, to this day, he's kind of embarrassed by it. He's like, please don't talk to me about Super Mario Brothers.
He did Moulin Rouge, too, right?
Yeah, he did, and that was a bad one, too, because they kept cutting his part down, because he was to lose the track, and yep. So, like, he's like, this gotta be this great Emmy Oscar-winning role, and he's like four lines or something ridiculous.
Poor guy.
Yeah, he's at the beginning of the movie, and then it goes away. But I thought he was great in that movie.
Yeah, he said that one was really painful to shoot, too, because he was shooting on his knees. Like, they had to build this contraption, and he's like, I went through all this pain and all this struggle, and then my part is so small. He's like, that was just so horrible.
He had some crazy costumes, too.
He said that one, and he was in Spawn, and he said those were the most two. Like, he's like, I'm never doing a show like that again. He's like, that was just, like, impossible to shoot, because it was... Just all the makeup and everything.
I don't know if you've ever saw the M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening.
No.
He plays a regular teacher. Mm-hmm. He can play those parts. He can go mm-hmm. to the extremes. Of, mm-hmm. And also a drug dealer in Carlito's Way. So he has this wide range.
He doesn't like doing those because it's kind of the stereotypical, but he's like, at some point, you just kind of need a paycheck.
And, uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he gets to work with De Palma and Pacino, too.
Yeah.
And maybe we should have like a 10-minute break for the tangent that Mike and Jeremy would have went on for both the Mario Brothers movie and the Spawn movie. They would have went off.
Future corrections. Right, so,
you can do it like you did with me, Z, for Zechariah now. Insert it here. Yeah. Minute later.
And now from Indianapolis, Mike on Spawn.
Bill?
Yeah, I want to talk about the Latin American actress Katie Girardo. Born in 1924 in Mexico, she was the first Latin American actress to be nominated for the Academy Award in the Western Broken Lance, which we have in our collection. This movie takes its inspiration from King Lear. She plays the second wife of the cattle baron Spencer Tracy in the movie. Instead of daughters, she has sons and stepsons. But the movie that first made an impression on me was High Noon, in which she played the saloon owner and mistress of Marshal Will Clayton, played by Gary Cooper. It's an amazing performance, and it's not what's said, but the actions and the reactions, which makes the movie fascinating. You know everything about the relationship in Katie Girardo, the character Helen, from the first shot of the movie. It's a really great performance and a great movie, too. But one of my favorite performances of Katie Girardo is in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, directed by Sam Peckinpah. Now, this movie is kind of legendary amongst film fans. And Peckinpah, Kris Kristofferson said during that movie, they drank so much mesquite, tequila, and whiskey that it does have this kind of hungover feeling in the movie. And she's in the movie for less than 10 minutes. And it's got all these great character actors from Slim Pickens to Chill Wills, just Jason Robards. Almost Billy Bob Thornton said they must have went out and got every great actor from Westerns to be in this movie. And I don't believe she has a line of dialogue, but you know about this character. And her final scene is both heartbreaking and beautiful. But the thing about it, it's just kind of this strange scene of Pat Garrett, played by James Coburn, comes up to Slim Pickens in the desert, and he's building this boat, and they go on this mission. So it's one of these movies that you have to see to truly appreciate. Katie Girardo had a true screen presence, and you can also stream two of her performances on Hoopla, Arrowhead, and the Badlanders. Badlanders I've always liked because it's a Western heist film. It's a remake of The Asphalt Jungle. So check out these films to see this one-of-a-kind actress, Katie Girardo, a true screen presence. Sarah?
So forgive me in advance, because I think some of the names I'm about to drop are probably going to be pronounced incorrectly, but I will push on.
That's never stopped us.
I figured it didn't, so I would just put that disclaimer out there, though. Okay, so as I don't get many opportunities to brag about the library's Wilson Limited Editions collection, except for the monthly blog, I thought I'd talk about one of the collection's unique and bizarre books. The collection includes a great variety of books from authors such as Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Jorge Luis Borges, Miguel de Cervantes, and many more. But I narrowed my list down to a book by Brazilian novelist Joaquim Maria Machado de Assis, more commonly known as simply Machado de Assis. The book is titled The Alienist. Ariane Press published their copy in 1998, though it was originally published around 1881. The story is actually a novella, which, if you're not familiar with that fun term, it's essentially a story that's longer than a short story, but still shorter than a novel.
Kind of like a booty.
Yeah, exactly. So now you've learned one new term for the day. But the story is a satire that was first named The Psychiatrist, but later translated to The Alienist. It follows the scientific efforts of Dr. Simon Bacamarte, again, forgive my probably incorrect pronunciation there, as he strives to discover a universal method to cure pathological disorders and essentially to distinguish sanity from madness. Well, as you can imagine, this drives the town he lives and works in mad, intentionally, which then leads to fear, conspiracy, and all sorts of other shenanigans. Crazy, right? Well, you'll have to come check out the Wilson copy if you're intrigued, because unfortunately, that is the only copy that the library owns. You won't regret it, though, since Machado de Assis is considered to be one of the greatest Latin American novelists of the 19th century and a precursor to several other greats such as Borges, Fuentes, Manuel Puig, and many more. The art is as unique as the story as well. The artist that illustrated this special edition was Carol Dunham. And ready for a fun fact?
I'm ready.
All right. He's the father of actress Lena Dunham.
Oh.
I discovered that yesterday.
Magic.
And his drawing's incredibly bizarre. So he also seems to have a real talent with every style of art, including cartoons, which is perfect because the artwork of the book actually reminds me of the old Nickelodeon cartoon, Ah, Real Monsters. So, yeah, giant teeth and unusual figures. If you remember that show, you can understand how bizarre these drawings really are. His drawings are without a doubt perfect for this bizarre story, though. If you don't feel a little off your rocker after reading this book, you probably started off a little kooky in the first place, which, according to this story, is not a bad thing. So check out the information below about the Wilson Collection and make an appointment today.
So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
No.
So I'm librarially illiterate. So explain the Wilson Collection. It's not check out a book, but it's like special. You have to, like you said, make an appointment. And...
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, good question. Wilson Collection is a combination of Arion Press and the Limited Editions Club. And it was donated to the library back in 2001. No, you cannot check it out, but if you want to come look at it, because it does have a lot of special edition books, you have to make an appointment with myself or Liz Coleman. And we'll pull out whatever books you want to see. Because we've got some cool ones. We've got ones illustrated by Picasso, Matisse,
and these are the white glove books. You have to wear white gloves.
Yeah.
I've seen you walk around with
this. They are the white glove books.
I just want to say, we talk about it like there are these special edition books. And like each one of these books is actually a work of art.
It's,
like you will be flabbergasted when you see these books. And you know, a lot of museums are like, no, you can't touch that. You can actually come and touch these books. You have to wear gloves. But it's like your own personal museum visit where you actually get to touch the items in the museum. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
And there's over 800 books, to clarify, so you can...
Yes.
So that would take some time.
Yes. It's not like you're going to come and there are 5 books. There's an entire room full of books.
Mm-hmm. Dedicated just for that room.
Yeah, it's an amazing collection. And each book is an amazing experience. Like, you could just come and look at one book for one visit, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's kind of
my favorite is probably Main Street that was illustrated by Grant Wood.
I like Grant Wood.
Yeah, illustrator of American Gothic. So they are kind of haunting images, but they're cool.
Yeah, or like A Season in Hell with photographs by Robert Mapplethorpe. It's good.
Yeah, oh gosh. Yeah, and Jim Dine. I don't even get me started on that guy.
Those are amazing books in the Wilson Collection. Mm-hmm. You should check it out. It's funny, though, you decided to talk about a novella. I was also going to talk about a novella. I've been on a book kick lately, even though I promised I wasn't going to read
anymore.
I was going to
say, you said I stopped reading, and then all I've done is talk about books since then.
Reinvigorated. But the book that I wanted to talk about was Signs Preceding the End of the World by Yuri Herrera. It's about Makina, a young woman in a rural Mexican mining town. Her mother wants her to deliver a secret message to her brother, who migrated north but has since lost contact with the family. Now, to do this, Makina has to make a deal with the local crime boss, the local heavy, and he says, okay, I'll give you the means to travel north across the border, but you also have to deliver a secret message for me. And this is pretty dangerous, too, because, like, what am I doing for this crime boss? Now, it's ironic that both messages are secret, because in her day job is that she's actually the old-fashioned switchboard operator in this little Mexican town. But then to travel north, she has to deliver secret messages instead of knowing everyone's business. And there's some sort of, like, something that's a dualism going on here, because the message she's delivering for her mother is, like, out of love. Oh, I mean, I'll do it for you, mother, because I love you. But then she's compelled, sort of against her will or by financial necessity, to deliver the message for the crime boss. And there's, like, a lot of metaphors there about, like, I think why people migrate to the United States from Mexico. Does she find her brother? Well, I don't want to say, but there is a twist. There is a twist ending that tears my heart out, and Pop-matic listeners will know that my heart being stomped is what I look for most in a book. That's a requirement for you to enjoy it. But really defines this book is the language. Though I am reading it in translation, it's...
The translator in question is Lisa Dillman.
It reads like poetry. And even though the plot is very, like, social realist, like, it's about the challenges and, like, harsh realities that people face when they migrate to the United States. But the prose is kind of, like, metaphorical and fairy tale-like. Like, the towns are never named. You know, it's like the city, the town, and the characters only have like first names. So it kind of reads like a fairy tale, even though the situation that it deals with are very realistic and it's very dreamlike. So it's sort of allegorical. I don't want to say what it is an allegory for, but the title of the book is Signs Preceding the End of the World. But it is like, there's like this dual ending. There's the actual real life ending of like what happens with her brother. And it's astonishing. It actually took me by surprise. I don't remember the last time I was actually surprised by a book. But then there's this dreamlike metaphorical ending that I'm not sure is supposed to be real, or like surrealist ending that I'm not sure how I'm supposed to interpret, and they both exist at once. A great little book. This is the first novel by Herrera to be translated into English. He's been publishing in Spanish for about 10 years, and he's kind of the literary hotness. So this was his first book published in English, has a lot of buzz. Definitely a great little book. As much a work of poetry as it is a novel, really short. You should check it out. That's Signs Preceding the End of the World by Yuri Herrera. And I was kind of disappointed to find out that Herrera actually like lives and teaches in the United States, but he's from Mexico.
I was going to ask you if you read his other books, but you don't read Spanish. I was like, that's the only one that's been translated.
I cannot read Spanish. You know, there might be a few more. The publisher was this neat little publisher called And Other Stories, and it's Empress and Other Stories. Like, that's the name of the publisher. What they publish is a lot of world literature in translation, but it's by subscription model. So if, like, you're a member of the club, right, like, you know, you pay a small fee, and then, you know, you can get the books delivered to you. Mm-hmm. So, and then they publish them, too. Like, anyone can buy them if they're published. So, and they publish a lot of really interesting stuff. Hey guys.
Yes, Brian?
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Sarah, you don't have this memorized, do you?
No, I do not. I'm sorry. I'll work on that. Send me the script next time.
She doesn't know why it's creepy either.
There's no script. This is the organically evolved. What I did was, we didn't have a good blurb or segue for that segment, or to say what it was. So I would go around the table every week and like pick on someone, hoping that one of the gang would come up with something on the fly.
We all failed miserably.
So eventually, it became us just saying that en masse, and it evolved.
You know? And like the first time he said it, it was like really creepy. He was like, Mike. And I don't know if he was just joking or what, but so then, like, we've always done it that way since then.
Maybe we need an editor. Amanda?
What?
What is tickling your fancy?
Well, I grew up in a pretty rural area. I was a 10-year 4-H member, and I actually had friends who were in the FFA. And if you don't know what either of those things are, go Google them right now.
Okay, I will. 4-H is a global organization that hopes to develop citizenship, leadership, responsibility, and life skills through experimental learning and positive youth development. The four H's stand for head, heart, hands, and health. FFA is the Future Farmers of America.
Whose house? Farmhouse!
I didn't live on a farm myself, but my grandpa had several plots of land where he would raise soybeans and corn, and once in a while we would ride with him in his combine or his tractor as he worked. And I actually learned how to drive in his field, driving his farm pickup back and forth across the harvested ground, because I think he didn't want me on the road. So I couldn't hurt anything out in the middle of nowhere. But now I live in the city, and granted, Nashville is not a completely, finger quotes, citified city like New York or LA. But I think as a whole, the city is more urban than most people realize, especially as it grows and gets bigger. And I've really noticed, it's really more noticeable for me when people complain about rainy weather. Because where I grew up in northern Indiana, people, you know, especially farmers, were thankful when it rained. Yay, it's raining, our crops are going to be good. Unless it was harvest and they needed dry fields, but whatever. Here, everyone whines when it's not like perfectly sunny. Oh, it's not, it's rainy. Oh, which I think is yucky. But anyway. So I've always had this fight in me between rural living and urban life, and recently a book came across my desk that a patron had ordered called Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. It's written by Kurt Timmermeister, and it piqued my interest. And so I was reading the book, Jack, and I thought, hey, I want to read that too.
Now, our library does not own a copy, but I can try to get it for you through interlibrary loan like I've done for the other two copies I've gotten. And if enough folks really want to read it, maybe I can talk Lori into buying us a copy or two. Now, as a restaurant owner in Seattle, Washington, Kurt became disenfranchised with the types of food that he was serving, and it got so bad that he wouldn't even eat in his own restaurant, which is a pretty good raving five-star review. So he tried to find a better path, and so he purchased about 4 acres of rundown land on the island of Vashon, I think is how you say it, which is near Seattle, and commuted back and forth to work while trying to build up a small farm. And eventually he sold his restaurants and took the proceeds of that and concentrated on building his farm full-time and expanded it to be about 12 acres. Now, when I started reading it, I was tempted to send this book back because I kind of thought it was going to be like some crazy hippie espousing the great benefits of raw dairy and farm-to-table produce. And while Kurt did go through a phase where he tried to sell raw milk and cheese, he was really rational and sane about it, and he eventually stopped because he was just so scared of a lawsuit for poisoning children with raw dairy, and then there were so many government regulations that he had to deal with, it just was too much and it was not profitable. But now, so he takes his dairy cows, and he takes their milk and makes high-quality pasteurized cheese that he's trying to build into a more full-time business. And he also hosts weekly dinners because, you know, he used to be a chef, so now he has these big dinners once a week where he serves only food grown on his farm. And it's not immensely profitable, but it definitely keeps food on his table. And now at this point, he's been doing it for over 20 years, so he really enjoys what he does. And I liked the book mostly because Kurt was so honest and appealing. And, you know, he admitted that he made some mistakes, but he always learned from them. And he also developed a great respect for the land that he was working and the animals that he was raising. And he kind of made me want to live on a farm because I really do miss all the fresh produce and other food that comes from one. It's totally not going to happen because I'm not going to be tied down to milking cows twice a day for the rest of my life. But maybe if I could find someone to do all the work and let me reap all the benefits, that might be something to consider.
I would be down with that.
Yeah, because I mean, that is one thing I miss about Nashville is that the produce here is just so sad from where I grew up, and it's so much more expensive. Mm-hmm. Stay lovey. All right, Mr. Bill.
Well, tickling my fancy are zombies in pop culture. The recent zombie invasion of pop culture has led to many wonder about the rise of The Walking Dead. Local professor and author Chris Paris talks about the origins of zombies, looking into anthropology, religion, folklore for answers. Paris graduated from Vanderbilt University with a PhD in religion, and he teaches courses in Bible, comparative religion, and cultural studies. His research focuses on narrative criticism and pop culture. This will be Saturday, September 19th at 10:30. Then, if that wasn't enough, and it should be, as David Letterman used to say, Movies at Maine will be showing White Zombie. With these zombie eyes, he rendered her powerless. White Zombie, 1932, stars Bela Lugosi and is what is considered the first feature-length zombie film and a model for future zombie movies. It's unrated, 69 minutes. That, too, will be shown September 19th, Saturday at 2 p.m. in our main auditorium. And I've got to admit that we're going to be showing the Blu-ray of this. And it's going to be looking pretty spectacular on our big screen. So one more time, learn all about zombies. Come Saturday, September 19th, 10:30 for the lecture. Then stay for the movie at 2 p.m. Sarah.
Nice. Gotta love zombies.
You have to bring a buddy. I don't like zombies.
All right, well, besides the fun of house hunting that's been tickling my fancy lately, actually the movie The Drop has also been on my radar for a while. If you guys have not discussed this already, I'm kind of surprised because it's really good. Me and another coworker have been on a Tom Hardy kick lately, and not the English novelist. I mean the really talented British actor that is best known as playing Bane in the new Batman trilogy. Yes, insert your imitation of Bane here.
I can't do it.
We'll pretend. It's actually interesting to reference his voice because he's actually one of the most versatile voice actors I've ever heard, and this movie is a good example. The Drop is based on the novel written by Dennis Lehane and is based in Brooklyn. Tom's character, Bob, is just a bartender at a small bar. He does what he's told, keeps his head down, until he finds himself mixed up in an investigation of a robbery gone awry.
Hi, gentlemen. These are in the house.
Thank you, Bobby. Cousin Marv, thanks for the drink, huh?
Thanks a lot, Marv.
In Brooklyn, money changes hands all night long.
And it's not the kind of money that you can deposit in a bank.
You hand over a drop.
But all that money needs to end up somewhere. They call it a drop bar. You just hide the entire city's dirty money right in plain sight.
All your money in the bag.
Do you know what you're doing? Do you know whose money you're jacking?
Fill the bag!
You don't see anything?
Nah. You know, that's this neighborhood, right?
I heard that Cousin Marv doesn't know the bar. Some hard guys do.
You're not a hard guy.
Yeah, we had a crew back in the day when we was young. Marv, he thought he was a tough guy. Then the neighborhood changed. It wasn't enough to be tough no more. You know, you had to be mean.
You know this guy?
No.
Find my money.
Find my money.
You need to see this, Marv.
No, I don't need to see what's in that bag.
No, don't look at that. Don't look at that.
You're still in the life.
Nope.
No, I just tend the bar.
You ever go around to the front of the bar and take a look at the names on the sign? You know, that's my name, because I used to own it once.
They pressed, you blinked, it's over. It's been over for a while now. I'm not this, and I'm not them.
Where is your cousin Marv? When I walked into a place people sat up straight, they noticed I was respected, I was feared. And that meant something.
Are you doing something desperate? Are you doing something that we can't clean up this time? There's some sins that you commit that you can't come back from.
Well, I'm stopping there to keep the synopsis short, but also to tease you, because you honestly just need to see it. It's an incredibly good movie co-starring Noomi Rapace, the original Elizabeth Salander, and James Gandolfini. Sadly, this was Gandolfini's last movie he ever made, and as any Dennis Lehane novel ends, it ends with a twist. We have both the book and the movie available at many branches right now, so be sure to check it out. Brian?
So we have not talked about The Drop, but we have talked about Tom Hardy,
okay.
Because Mike is a Tom Hardy fan. And what I've noticed about this podcast is that we're actually, and I mean this totally lovingly, like nerd weirdos. And so like sometimes there are these big like UFOs of pop culture sort of like hovering over the library, and we don't talk about that. We talk about whatever's behind the big other mothership UFO, the small UFO, but sometimes it's good to unearth, you know, the secrets of the library.
That's true.
I did want to see The Drop, and thank you for reminding me to put it on hold. But I think you buried the lead a little bit, too. He was in Mad Max Fury Road.
I haven't seen that one yet, but yes, you're correct. Yes.
While we're talking, I'm very much looking forward to his new film, Legends, where he plays the Kray twins.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pumped about that.
And he was the original, I guess, Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights. I haven't seen that one either, but that's an older movie.
Tom Hardy's the hotness right now.
He is.
Why can't we escape Mike and Jeremy? Like, we've casually mentioned Tom Hardy, talking about him for like 10 minutes. And I'm going to talk about a comic book.
Someone had to.
But there's a twist. So it's a comic book that is the hotness in comic books right now. That's The Wicked and the Divine by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. And the premise is that pop stars are actually reincarnated gods that live for 2 years and then die. Just pop stars that are really popular, like Rihanna or Lady Gaga or David Bowie. Like, the idea is that these are actually reincarnated gods, and they're popular for a little while, and then they burn out. So that's the premise.
It seems like it's very far off.
That sounds about right.
So, in some ways, it's very clever, but in another way, I just kind of feel like Neil Gaiman happened already. We do not need another urban fantasy series where gods are among men, you know, as sexy young mortals. I get it already, okay? But one of the things that makes it great, as with most comics, even though the plot is a little thin, is McKelvey's art is amazing. It's actually very kind of cold and distant. You know, my heart is cold and distant. And I love that. And the colors are super vibrant. There's just like this like distance and like preciseness to the art. that I really like. And this comic is really popular right now. It's won a bunch of awards. And the library has the first two volumes that are collect, you know, the sort of the first two story arcs. The third story arc is currently in print, coming out as monthly issues. Now, what is tickling my fancy, Barry the lead, is that Grimes, one of my favorite musical artists, actually did the variant cover for the 14th issue, which is the newest issue. And that was like really kind of, I was like, could figure out why my blogosphere and Twitter feed was all of a sudden going crazy about this comic that's been out for a couple years. And it's because Grimes did one of the covers. So check out the variant cover for the 14th issue of The Wicked and the Divine.
So how many issues are there that have been?
I think that there are like 5 or 6 in each of the volumes. Mm-hmm. And it's so popular right now, like volume 2, like has a, not a ton of holds, but it has holds on it. But
a comfortable list?
Yeah, you can get the first one.
You said Karen Gillian? What's the?
Kieran Gillian.
Okay, yeah. Never mind.
Who's Karen Gillian? Tell me.
Well, Doctor Who.
She was
one of the
companions. Kieran Gillen, who's a dude, and Jamie McKelvey, who's also a dude. And one of the things that I don't like about this comic book, even though it's good, I liked it. I liked it a lot. It was good. But it was like this weird thing where it's clearly written for adults and rated R. And it's not like it's Quentin Tarantino or anything. But it's clearly written for adults and rated R. But it's about like an adolescent girl that finds out that maybe she's one of these gods after she sort of worships all these pop stars. So there's sort of the teen coming of age young adult arc, but it's clearly written for adults. And I'm like, huh, maybe this was written by adolescent man boys. What do you know? That's what comics needs. But it is a clever premise and it is a beautiful book, The Wicked and the Divine.
Last week.
At the very beginning, it was Chris Farley impersonating Hank Williams Jr., doing his best Monday Night Football. At the very end, that was an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. The movie they were lampooning was Laser Blast. The actor Dennis Berkeley kind of looks like Hank Williams Jr., so anytime he came on camera, they would say, "Are you ready for some football?" It's funny that show got canceled. Jeremy is not here, but he wanted me to do some dirty work and basically nitpick Amanda and Bill.
This is my shocked face. So,
I know, he's like, still wants to be on the show even though he's not here. He wanted me to tell you, Amanda, that you said wedgies, and the word that he knows is wedges. For that.
Well, that was the author's word. Because I use wedges, too. So I will agree with that, but her word was wedgies.
Bill, he basically wanted to point out that you said Dr. Bennett Omalu's name correct the first time, and then not every time after. And then he also wanted to point out that he thought that Mark Fineru Wada's name was easy to pronounce. He doesn't know why you had trouble pronouncing it. So.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here, Bill made a hand gesture that does not translate well to an audio format.
We'll save that for next week. Well, I have a correction, too. It's actually kind of a clarification. Because I had mentioned the term, because you talked about wedges. I mentioned the term booties. And I think, like, in listening, I was confused when Mike started talking about it. Because he's like, they make those for adults? And I was like, yeah. Well, I think he thinks that they were like baby booties. Like the little socks with the little, no, that's not what booties are. Booties are like boots, but smaller. Like, they usually are shorter on the top. Sometimes they have, like, a higher heel. Like, Sarah's nodding. She gets it.
I get it.
But, yeah. So, booties are not baby booties. They're, like, cool adult human shoes.
Fashion boots.
Fashion. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Not socks.
I dig it.
Because then you started talking about socks, and I was like, what? I didn't get it, but I didn't get the reference.
Your shoes.
So.
in listening back, I learned.
Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, the guy that's not here today because he went to Indianapolis for a Motorhead concert did not get the reference to fashion boots.
Yeah, shocked.
So for more information about booties and Motorhead, you can go to www.library.nashville.org. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week, Mars Ho!
I am the Martian Ambassador.
Mars?
John Leguizamo is here. He is an actor and a writer, a comedian. In fact, some say his work defies categorization. He has played everything from a gangster in Carlito's Way to Tybalt in William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. He is now on Broadway. He is starring in his fifth one-man show. It is called Ghetto Clown, and here is a look.
And when I wrote Mambo Mouth, man, it was because we were nowhere to be seen, man. We were like an invisible people everywhere in the media and... So I wrote this whole play about my neighborhood, and it was an incredible feeling to be up there saying my own words. It was so freeing. It was so amazing. It wasn't even me, it was shamanism.